What do you do when you see someone's hand get pinched in a door? Maybe you wince. If you're like most people, you feel a sense of empathy. You imagine, even for a split second, the pain that person must be feeling. But what if you couldn't feel empathetic? Could a lack of empathy explain cruelty? We'll talk with researcher Simon Baron Cohen about the science of evil. Plus, the new movie Contagion is a frightening, star-studded look at what happens when a lethal virus turns epidemic. We'll talk with the real-life virus hunter who made sure the filmmakers got the science right. And China launches a space lab. PBS science correspondent Miles O'Brien is here to talk about the country's space ambitions and what the Chinese launched into space. Well, coming up after the break, stay with us. Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard? You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/scifry. Or you can tweet us all week long at scifry. That's at S-C-I-F-R-I. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. China launched its first space laboratory this week. The unmanned Tiangong-1, or Heavenly Palace 1, left the Gobi Desert yesterday, entered Earth orbit. China plans to launch another unmanned craft, and according to a Chinese state media statement, to, quote, experiment in rendezvous and docking, and to eventually develop a space station. Sounds very familiar. So will China one day have its own version of the International Space Station, complete with astronauts? Maybe it's a step in going to the moon. Joining me now to talk more about it is my guest, Miles O'Brien. He's a journalist. He's been covering aviation, space, and science for 30 years. He's a science correspondent for the NewsHour on PBS. Welcome to Science Friday, Miles.
Ira, it's a pleasure.
My joy. What do you know about this spacecraft here?
Well, you wouldn't call it a space race, would you? Because the,
no.
The Chinese, I guess if you were measuring it in geological time frames, yes. But they move in a very plodding way, a methodical way. And those who would suggest that there's some sort of new space race underway, frankly, I think say so a bit wistfully, hoping there'll be another space race because, after all, it fueled a lot of expense and spending on this side to go to the moon.
Well, so they're not in a race with anybody, but they're going to be making progress doing something, I would imagine.
Yeah, this is a key thing. To call this a space station is a bit of a stretch. It's not designed to keep people up there indefinitely, as the International Space Station does, now more than a decade, of course, in that case. In this case, as time goes on and as they add to it, they will tend it for longer periods of time. What's really crucial about this, Ira, is this will demonstrate to them and to the world that they can rendezvous and dock at a target. That's a significant piece of the space puzzle. If you're really going to be a player in space, you have to solve the rendezvous and docking problem, and that is not a simple problem. And so this is their target, if nothing else, to dock to. They'll fly a couple of unmanned missions to do that. And then at the end of 2012, the plan is to send some Chinese taikonauts to spend a shorter period of time, but eventually longer periods of time for later crews at this tended object.
Have they not expressed their desire to go to the moon someday?
Yeah, we've heard that. We've heard, talk about maybe one day going to Mars. There's all kinds of grand aspirations there. They just have moved in a very slow way. Their first manned flight was back in 2003. They've flown three manned missions. Last one was in 2008. So they're moving in a slow process. But I guess in the context of Chinese history, that it's a perfectly appropriate timescale, right?
Right. Well, the obvious question is we don't have a spacecraft to go to the International Space Station. The Russians don't have one now either. Why not ask the Chinese?
Why shouldn't we hedge our bets? Why shouldn't we be able to hail another taxi, as it were, right?
Exactly.
And this gets into a lot of geopolitics, as you can imagine. The Chinese space program is pretty opaque to the rest of the world, to say the least. There are a lot of political considerations in play when you start partnering with the Chinese. The concern, of course, is that U.S. technology would be borrowed and not returned, so to speak, by the Chinese. And so there is reluctance to create the kinds of partnerships that you would need in order to have a Chinese spacecraft docking at the International Space Station. Now, they haven't even proved they can dock yet. Now, we'll see. If they start docking at this tended object and they succeed, maybe that will change, but the politics may not.
And I understand that on this space station are some International Space Station flags that were brought on board.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chinese, frankly, they would like to be a part of the International Space Station if they had their druthers. But right now, the politics don't work so well. The Chinese have a long and fruitful relationship with the Russian space program. I mean, if you look at their manned capsule, the Shenzhou, it looks just like a Soyuz rocket. It's not a complete knockoff. It's a little bit larger, and the inside is modified to their liking. But the truth is, the Russians and the Chinese have worked together. When I was in Star City years ago, there were some Chinese taikonauts there at the time. I was told to look the other way. It was kind of unofficial at that time. And so they have this strong relationship. I think if the Russians were calling the shots, the Chinese might be a part of the space station. But of course, the U.S. has a say-so in that.
CCTV, the Chinese TV, released video animation of the craft, and playing behind in the background was America the Beautiful.
Yeah, that
How can that be a mistake?
That is either some really strange irony or somebody's in deep trouble today. Ira and is in a cell right next to the Tiananmen Square tank guy or something. I don't know.
It was very funny. We were watching it on the internet. So they're going to launch this second ship, something to, as you say, to prove they can rendezvous with this space vehicle. No people will be on board this one either. But this seems to be saying, if I hear you correctly, sort of planting a flag into a next generation of space travel. They're saying, we're here. We're not only eating your lunch in production of consumable goods, we're now getting into the space business.
Yeah, you know, you say the next generation, but in a way, what they're doing is seems to be a bit of an anachronism of another era. You know, we sort of have been there and done this, but this is also part of it. The big picture here is Chinese their view of superpower status and supremacy in the world, and it is their view. I've talked to them over the years, trying to get in the door there and do some work there. It's kind of hard to get in. It is their view that this is a big part of, if nothing else, the geopolitics, the soft power that space exerts in the world.
Of course, they showed us some of their power years ago when they blew up a satellite, did they not?
And this is what gives people a little pause in the West. In 2007, the Chinese had a defunct weather satellite. For reasons no one fully really understands outside of the Chinese military. And it is a military-controlled program. Let's not forget that. In any case, they lobbed a ballistic missile at their own defunct satellite and obliterated it to prove they could do it. But what was the consequence of this was it created just thousands and thousands of pieces of hazardous space junk in low Earth orbit. And it also made an interesting statement about the Chinese space program. How much is it a militaristic? How much is it about Star Wars? How much is it about, you know, the space shuttle and a space station?
Mm-hmm. Of course, all our astronauts were military people to begin with also.
Well, you know, I mean, we make, of course, Eisenhower was very clear when he created NASA, let's make it a civilian program, but it was populated by military people. So that might have been a difference without a distinction to the rest of the world, including the Chinese.
Well, Miles, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
For taking time to be with us. Miles O'Brien, who you can see on PBS, and he's a correspondent for PBS and a science journalist, been on 30 years or so. You can see his reports on the NewsHour on PBS.
When dinosaurs roam the earth.
Up next, the science of evil. How are some people capable of causing extreme harm to others? Are they hardwired to do it, or can their behavior be tracked back to a troubled upbringing? My next guest has written a book that asks what makes someone evil, and he says that empathy might have something to do with it. That's the ability to recognize and respond to someone else's feelings. Could lowered empathy cause cruelty? Simon Baron Cohen is author of The Science of Evil. He's a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge in the UK and director of the university's Autism Research Center there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Baron Cohen.
Thank you very much.
Can you give us a definition of what empathy is or what empathy is not?
Well, you just gave a very good definition. I think it has two parts. The first part is recognition of somebody else's state of mind. So can you identify what someone else is thinking and feeling? But the second part is the response element. Do you have an appropriate emotional response to somebody else's thoughts and feelings? I think just having one part without the other wouldn't really count as empathy. If you could recognize that someone was in pain, for example, but you didn't do anything about it, that wouldn't really be empathy.
Interesting. And how is that connected and to the title of your book, The Science of Evil?
So when we try to explain why people are capable of cruelty, often we use this term evil as if it's an explanation. You know, we say he did something bad because he's evil. Mm-hmm. But actually, when you examine the word, it's not really an explanation at all. I mean, within a theological context or framework, it might perhaps suggest that there's some kind of demonic possession. But for a scientist, it doesn't really explain why people are capable of cruelty. So I've been arguing in this book that we should instead use the term empathy and the erosion of empathy to explain how people are capable of hurting other people.
Mm-hmm. And because it's an emotion, and it must be some location for it in our brains, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, empathy is not just an emotion, but you're right, it does involve, as we said, that response element, which is having an emotional response to somebody else's state of mind. But it's also got this cognitive element, that's to say the recognition element. And as you say, it's ultimately a function of the brain. And part of the reason for writing this book is that the neuroscience has been making great strides over the last decade. And I wanted to bring together all the work that's showing where empathy works in the brain. We've got MRI these days, magnetic resonance imaging, and you can get people to lie in the scanner whilst they're looking at, for example, film clips of other people's facial expressions or their situation, often in painful situations. And you can see which parts of the brain are activated by seeing someone else's state of mind.
And can you teach people who are not empathetic to recognize these emotions?
You can do that. So empathy isn't a fixed quantity. Although there are individual differences in empathy, it's not as if your level of empathy necessarily remains static all your life. You can learn it. It can be taught. And this is often the basis of social skills teaching, for example, but also many therapies have empathy as the target.
Mm-hmm. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Go to our Facebook page. Talking with Simon Baron-Cohen. Dr. Cohen, Baron-Cohen is author of The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. We'll take a short break. Our number again, 1-800-989-8255. Tweet at SciFry, SCIFRI. We'll be right back after this break. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Dr. Simon Baron-Cohen, author of The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Does the lack of empathy have a direct line to cruelty?
So that's the main claim I'm making in my book. But it turns out that a low level of empathy doesn't necessarily lead to cruelty. So the way I see it is it's not a symmetric relationship, that when people do cruel things, they must have had a reduction in their empathy. But if you have low empathy, it doesn't necessarily lead to cruelty. The reason we know that is from people with autism. They, too, struggle with empathy, but they don't necessarily go on to hurt other people. Instead, they tend to avoid other people because they find relationships confusing.
Mm-hmm. So do we all then somewhere lie on some scale of empathy, a spectrum of empathy?
Yeah, that's the sort of new view. I guess in the old days we would say that empathy was just like a unitary thing, that you either have it or you don't. Mm-hmm. whereas today we think of it more as a dimension, and you can measure it to see those individual differences. Most of us are average in empathy, but there are some people who are very high, and obviously some people very low. And part of what my book does is explores the reasons why people might end up very low in empathy.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can go to the phones now. Let's go to Chad in Auburn, New York. Hi, Chad.
How are you this afternoon?
Hi there.
I think your guest is right on with respect to his conclusions. I've been a town judge here for 16 years, but I do believe that there's a spectrum of people who lack empathy that can't be fixed. There's an awful lot of young people that maybe lack empathy for the people that they're hurting, that they're having a negative impact on. But I think that there are a number of people who have come before me that really define evil because they have absolutely zero consideration for their impact of their behavior on others. Even after you explain and describe that impact, they simply can't incorporate
it. Yeah. So I think you're making two points, because first point is that there are some people who really can't appreciate the impact of their own behavior on others. And I agree with you. I mean, I've met people like that. But I wouldn't necessarily call those people evil. I see that as a neurological disability, no different to other kinds of disabilities. But in this case, the brain is not allowing them the capacity of empathy. I think your other point was that those people can't be helped, that their empathy is fixed once and forever at a very low level. And I guess I'm taking a more optimistic view that sometimes it looks like people are not capable of development, but sometimes you have to take a very long-term view. And the mind may change very slowly, but development is possible.
Thanks for calling, Chad. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. So at what point does empathy turn to being evil? How would you define it then?
Well, I mean, I've been trying to shift the debate away from using the term evil towards simply low empathy. Mm. You know, your last caller was, raising the important context of the judicial system, because people with low empathy can sometimes hurt others and break the law. And, it's very important that we realize that low empathy can lead an individual into the criminal justice system.
Is there somewhere something different in the brain circuitry between a normal person's brain and low empathy?
Yeah, and that's really part of the advance of MRI, is that you can take a group of people with, say, a personality disorder. Many of the personality disorders involve low empathy. You can put them into the scanner, and you can look for differences in the empathy circuit. So empathy isn't really located in one region. By my count, there are at least 10 different parts of the brain that are activated when you're trying to empathize with another person. And in people with, say, antisocial personality disorder who have low empathy, you see reduced activity in many parts of that empathy circuit. You also see that the size of the regions in the empathy circuit may not have developed to the normal size.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question, a tweet coming in from C-SPAN Democrat who wants to know, are not sociopaths without empathy?
Well, yeah, we were just talking about psychopaths, and they are part of what's called antisocial personality disorder, also called sociopaths, and they do lack empathy. They tend to lack what's called the affective part of empathy. That's to say that although they can identify what someone might be thinking or feeling, they don't really care about other people's thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm. What about a gender difference? Is there a difference between men and women in empathy?
Well, certainly when it comes to the extremes, people who have very low empathy, we tend to see far more males than females. So psychopaths, for example, tend to be male. But even if you look in the general population, there is a small but statistically significant sex difference, gender difference in empathy, that females tend to score higher on most tests of empathy.
Mm-hmm. You know, psychiatry today is so involved with medications and throwing pills and things at psychiatric symptoms. I'm sure there must be somebody looking for a pill for low empathy somewhere.
Well, you're right. That research has started along that road. And there's a particular interest in a hormone called oxytocin, which gets quite a lot of press these days. So oxytocin, if you take an extra dose of it, seems to improve people's ability to read other people's faces.
Is that right? And that is one of the problems, is not being able to read and understand the pain or whatever is on someone else's face.
Yeah, for some people, their difficulties are about interpreting other people's facial expressions of emotion. And that's certainly true in the group with autism or Asperger's syndrome, that reading other people's faces or their tone of voice, their intentions, can be quite difficult. But going back to the question of drugs, I'm not suggesting that, the way to improve empathy is necessarily through a medication route, because certainly there are plenty of psychological approaches, too, that are being tried.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Paula in Toledo. Hi, Paula.
Hi, how are you doing? I've been on hold. I've been getting this sort of, weird flashback to Clockwork Orange as I'm listening to this discussion. It seems so dispassionate, and the solutions kind of put that in my mind. The reason I called was because I was curious to know if the author had any familiarity with the MacArthur Genius Award recipient who had done a study on her kindergarten class and a basic sort of cruelty that she saw forming in her kindergarten class with children who were socially up and children who were socially down. The kids in the up category wouldn't let the social outcasts play with them, and they actually became social outcasts by virtue of the exclusion of the in crowd. And, this is sort of a thing that gets just more and more intense as children go through school and really get sophisticated at the high school level. I was wondering if any of his research had looked at this rather basic, not really pathological, or at least we don't think of it as pathological, cruelty that people tend to engage in.
Yeah, no, you've made two really important points. The first is that when we're thinking about people who struggle with empathy, we shouldn't lose our own compassion. If the discussion was sounding scientific and detached, maybe that's part of the focus of this show. But actually, you're absolutely right that ultimately there are people involved here who are struggling. And, I think your second point is that we don't have to go to the extremes of, for example, people with psychopathic personality disorder to see examples of how we can hurt each other. That we see this in everyday society. Mm-hmm. You're describing people who really turn against another group because they're not part of their in-group. And this is a well-studied area within social psychology, that you can reduce your empathy towards another group of people just because they're not part of your group. So social factors are very important.
Now, we've gotten a lot of tweets about that. Maybe we can expand on that. I'll just go through a couple of the ideas in the tweets. What about social media decreasing empathy because of the ideas that people encounter on them every day? Can environmental factors reduce empathy, or is it innate?
Sure. So this is really raising the big question about where our empathy comes from and what determines how much empathy you end up with. And I think there is some evidence for genetic factors, and that comes from looking at twins, because identical twins tend to have more similar levels of empathy than non-identical twins. But social factors are certainly very important, and some of the best evidence for that comes from people who end up with borderline personality disorder, people who have a lot of difficulty regulating their relationships and can show extreme anger towards others. But many of those people have suffered extreme abuse or neglect in their childhood. So early experience contributes to how much empathy you end up with. It doesn't directly address the issue about social media, but it may well be, I don't know of any studies in that, it may well be that other social factors can influence our level of empathy.
Can you notice it in yourself that you lack empathy and try to get some help? Or does somebody else have to help you?
Well, this is a tricky one, because empathy often goes hand in hand with self-awareness, that people who are good at empathy are not only good at picking up on other people's feelings, but they're also good at reflecting on their own behavior. And so someone who's low in empathy may be the last person to realize that, and it may mean that other people around them have to give them a little bit of feedback, or it may be that they seek help anyway, and discovered that they have empathy difficulties.
Well, Dr. Simon Baron-Cohen, thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Very enlightening.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Dr. Baron-Cohen is author of The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. Up next, it's time for our monthly episode of Science Diction, where we explore the origins of scientific words with Howard Markel, professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Welcome to Science Friday. Welcome
Hello,
back.
Ira.
Tell us what the word is today. Is it?
The word today is epilepsy.
Epilepsy.
A very odd word. It's, as we know today, of course, it's an abnormal firing of neurons in the brain that leads to some abnormal movement of one part of the body or another, depending on what part of the brain is affected. But for a long time, that disease was terribly feared, and many people thought it was a sacred disease, that somehow people were struck by either a god or a devil to have this uncontrollable movement. And it's very frightening to watch, actually, and so people were very nervous when they saw other people seize.
It seems like at one point or another, Hippocrates described every disease and disorder out there.
He did. You could always rely on Hippocrates. You know, there is a Greek word. There's many Greek words, actually. But this one, epilambinum, and in Latin it's epilepsia. Mm-hmm. And that literally means to seize or to be taken hold of. And Hippocrates wrote a wonderful treatise called On the Sacred Diseases. And he said, you know, he described epilepsy to a T because he was such a good observer. But he said, this disease is no more sacred than any other disease. It's affecting some part of the brain, and he explained it in the way he understood the body in terms of four bodily humors and so on. But he was the first one to actually strike out against it being a part of evil or doing bad or a weakness of character or something like that, and he did not like that name. Later on, it became the falling sickness, and that's what it was called for millennia. And really, even in the English language, for a long time, it was referred to as the falling sickness, but that all changed around 1578.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR, talking with Howard Markel about the definition of the word epilepsy. When did anybody, you say it's the falling sickness, is that because they were able to define it as a real illness?
Well, yeah, I mean, now epilepsy we know is really many disorders,
right.
40 or 50 disorders that include seizures, but when people suffered from what used to be called grand mal seizures or, you know, generalized seizures, they would often fall down. And it struck them and they fell down or they started seizing. And it was not a bad name. But Henry Light in 1578, he was a famous British botanist, translated another botanist book called Krutebuk by Rembert Dodendens. He was a Flemish botanist. And there were some recipes of how to treat seizures in there. And Light preferred the word epilepsy to falling sickness, and so he used that translation. But, you know, it took another couple of decades, and it wasn't, of course, you know, if you talk about the Greeks and the Bible, then right. You had to have Shakespeare. Shakespeare described epilepsy in 1599 in his famous play Julius Caesar. Now, Julius Caesar did have epilepsy, and Cassius describes him as having, quote, the falling sickness. But what's really neat is about a few years later in 1603 in Othello, Shakespeare describes him as raging and foaming as if he has fallen into epilepsy. And again, the following year in 1604 in King Lear, Kent talks to Oswald and says, a plague upon your epileptic visage. That would be a good thing in the playground to say to someone you don't like. But after that, epilepsy really took hold, and it became the way we describe this falling sickness.
Yeah, and a lot of famous historical people had epilepsy.
Yeah, epilepsy, or at least seizures. You know,
right.
there was Julius Caesar, Napoleon, Dostoevsky, one of my favorite novelists, and in fact, he gave his character Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment epilepsy as well. And probably the most humorous, if you're an Abbott and Costello fan, Bud Abbott had epilepsy.
Had no idea.
Yeah, he was not on first when it came to that problem.
I'm glad you said it and I did, because I would have. Do we know actually what causes epilepsy today?
Well, it depends on what type of epilepsy you have and what part of the brain has been affected. There are a number of causes. For example, if you injure your brain, say you hit your head against something and you cause some scarring of the brain tissue, that could be a cause. But so too can tumors or metabolic disorders. There are a number of causes that cause the syndrome of epilepsy.
Is it an easy word to research?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, you start with the Oxford English Dictionary, as I always do, and then you work your way back, and then you start finding out who these people are. So Hippocrates is easy, and I had known the sacred diseases from my days in graduate school. But I got to meet Henry Light along the way, and it's always a great excuse to read Shakespeare.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Shakespeare did incorporate it.
He did, and there's so many. I mean, he was such a wonderful observer of human nature and things that affected human beings, and so there's lots of medicine and science to be described in the plays of Shakespeare.
Yeah. Well, Howard, once again, you've done it again.
Well, thank you,
Ira. When you figure out what that is, you'll let me know.
Yeah, we'll see who's on first then, huh?
All right. Have a good weekend. Howard Markel is professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. And if you want to read more about epilepsy, check out our website at sciencefriday.com, and we'll give you a whole bunch of stuff there. After the break, a look at the behind-the-scenes science of the movie Contagion. We may give away, some plot of the movie. So, we maybe want to podcast it later after you've seen the movie. But we'll talk about Contagion with a scientist who is very much involved in making sure the science was done right in the movie, because it's all about the spread of disease. We'll talk about it after the break, so stay with us. Do you like movies and films about science? I've got a special event for you, October 14th through 21st, the 4th Annual Imagine Science Film Festival will showcase its largest collection of science films to date, with new events, panels, and receptions, including science shorts, real footage from lab experiments, and child-friendly films. For more information, visit www.imaginesciencefilms.com. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, a look at the science behind the scenes of the new movie, Contagion.
The average person touches their face 3 to 5 times every waking minute. In between, we're touching doorknobs, water fountains, and each other.
And that's a scene from the movie Contagion, talking about how the virus in the movie is spread from person to person. And if you haven't seen it, we'll try not to give too much away here. We waited actually a few weeks until after the movie was out so that we could talk about it, and you will have seen it and you'll understand what we're talking about. So if you have seen the movie, you probably left the theater like I did, a little scared, wondering if what happened on screen could really happen in real life. And the movie follows the spread, as I say, of a virus which quickly turns into an epidemic. And part of the reason I think that the movie is so scary is because it sticks closely to reality. There are no zombies, no miracle cures, no Arnold Schwarzenegger-type superheroes, just biologists with Eppendorf pipettes who try and save the day. And so how did the film get the science right? With the help of a scientist, of course, and he's here to talk with us now. Ian Lipkin was the senior technical advisor for the movie Contagion. At his day job, he's a virologist. He's a professor of epidemiology and the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Lipkin.
My pleasure. Love your show.
Thank you. How'd they get the word epidemiology wrong in the movie? You weren't on call that day.
No, I had to go home periodically.
Now, this is interesting because you were not brought on at the end of the movie to fact check it, but right involved at the very beginning.
That's correct. And I've been asked to do movies like this in the past, but this was the first time I was convinced that they were really sincere in wanting to get things correct. That's not to say everything is correct in the movie, but, it's a feature film. It's not a documentary. Mm-hmm. It's really very good.
So did you come up with the virus for this movie?
Yes. We throw out a number of candidates to Scott Z. Burns and to Steven Soderbergh, and this is the one they liked the best, which was fortunate because this is the one that we like the best as well. It makes sense. It's built on something that we've seen. It's probable. I shouldn't say it's probable. It's plausible. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. I mean, there was a lot of opportunity to do interesting things with it cinematically.
And what was it based on?
It's based on a virus that was originally described in Malaysia that went from bats to pigs and was associated with encephalitis, primarily in pig farmers. And this was in the late 1990s. More recently, there have been some other reports in Bangladesh where it's transferred directly from bats to people through beverages. People tap trees for palm syrup and basically drink that as a beverage, and the bats can contaminate that. And it causes a respiratory illness and an encephalitis. It doesn't spread rapidly from person to person, but it could with mutation and evolution. Mm-hmm. So that was the modification that we suggested.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted the virus to look scary in people, too. So
exactly.
You added some foaming of the mouth and seizures and things like that.
Well, you know, your discussion just before the break was about epilepsy. So he neglected to mention the most common cause worldwide of epilepsy right now, which is MEV1. It's playing on every cinema theater.
Wow. Wow, that is scary.
Well, not for Warner Brothers.
you have actual personal experience with the outbreak of viruses. You were quarantined during the SARS outbreak, right?
Yeah, that's correct. In May of 2003, I went to China and actually used much of my experience there to help describe what scenes would look like, you know, deserted streets and airports and such. And when I came back, I became ill, and people thought that I had SARS. I felt that I didn't because my diagnostic test ruled it out, but I was indeed put in a quarantine. So I was able to talk to Matt Damon in the film about what that was like to not be able to be in close contact with loved ones. So a lot of this reflects experiences of people who've been involved with this film, personal experiences, which is one of the reasons it resonates with the audience.
There's a character scientist named Ian in the film. Is that there Ian
is.
Lipkin?
Yes. Well, that's a character played by Elliot Gould. I'd been hoping for Matt Damon, but you know, it's the way it goes. But yes, that character is based on me.
And so you actually trained some of the stars like Elliot Gould and other people to look like scientists and act like scientists?
Yeah, so Elliot, I only spent a few hours training, and essentially just to make sure that he was safe because he was reaching into liquid nitrogen with bare hands, and that wouldn't have been a good thing. Mm. But Jennifer Ely, who plays the scientist at the CDC who identifies the virus and grows it and vaccinates herself, I'm spoiler alert there, I'm afraid. And Kate Winslet both spent a couple of days in the lab training and learning how to look through microscopes and work with pipettes and all these other sorts of things. And then I spent a fair amount of time with Gwyneth Paltrow working on her seizure, for example, to make that look realistic.
If anybody can look good having a seizure.
Absolutely.
It's Gwyneth Paltrow. but was Kate Winslet injecting herself? Was that realistic?
Well, that was Jennifer, actually. So the initial injection. So as I say, I do have a day job. So periodically, I would go offset. And during one of the times that I was offset, there was a decision that Jennifer would inject herself with this vaccine through her tights. And we were actually helping to record some of the soundtrack for laboratory sounds and cages rolling down halls. And as this film was rolling, I watched Jennifer inject herself through the tights, and I said, whoa, 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 what's going on here? And we went back, and they said, well, she's really in a hurry. I said, no one is in that much of a hurry. She would take the time to roll down those tights and to wipe off her legs. So they actually brought her back, which was not an inexpensive thing to do, to reshoot that scene. And in so doing, not only did they shoot the scene properly, but we got a chance to see Jennifer Ely's thighs, which has also, you know, helped, I think, with movie sales.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. But I'm impressed that they thought enough about the accuracy that they would spend money to do that. Is that right? Would that impress you too, I imagine?
It did. I mean, Scott Z. Burns and Steven Soderbergh, and as well as the people who put up the initial support for it, Participant Media, wanted to be involved with education. Both of the the parents of Burns and Soderbergh are both academics, so they have a lot of respect for academia and for scientists in general. And so I was involved reading scripts right along for a very long time. They had other people as well. Larry Brilliant was reading. Laurie Garrett was reading, and so forth. So we spent a lot of time going over these, you know, a number of times it would be something we'd put up which just wouldn't make any sense. And inevitably, they would revise it.
Yeah. You know, in this movie, it's interesting is that the Centers for Disease Control seems to be the hero. The CDC is the hero in this movie, as where it might have been the demon if it had been someone, you know, like FEMA or something like that in another scenario.
Absolutely. That's correct. And there are a number of heroes. Actually, each of these characters is modeled after somebody whom one of us has encountered in real life. So Jude Law, who plays this blogger who sells false hope, is been named after somebody who's been, you know, casting doubt on the validity of vaccines. And we have people who die who are named after people like Carlo Urbani, who died during SARS. So I can see my friends in each one of these characters. Lawrence Fishburne, for example. Some of the characters are amalgams of people that we represent because, you know, there wasn't any other good way to do it. But by and large, it's quite accurate, and it's rooted in reality.
So does that mean that you had a say in how the movie would end, how it eventually the virus would play out?
Well, Steven Soderbergh is definitely the boss, and he has his vision. And Scott, of course, is the person who helps him develop that vision. My role was to say what's possible, what's plausible, what's feasible, what's not possible. And to some extent, that's incorporated, but it's definitely Scott and Steven's vision, certainly not mine.
Mm-hmm. The vaccine gets produced. I think one of the most interesting, and I love the movie because it was interesting how it spread. It spread very quickly. But one of the things that didn't seem that believable to me was how quickly they could make a vaccine in that movie. I mean, today it takes months and whatever, you know?
That's a criticism that I've heard from several people, but I don't agree. First of all, using molecular methods, we can make vaccines very quickly. Not for all viruses. Obviously, we've not succeeded yet with HIV, but for a virus like this, which causes very rapid disease, and for which we are able to grow the virus, and it's not really evolving that rapidly, we can make a vaccine very, very quickly. The problems really are logistical and regulatory. Mm-hmm. How do you make enough of it to distribute, and how do you get it through the FDA and the other bodies that need to approve it? But we do have, in government, ways in which we have, I don't want to call them loopholes, but basically that's what they are, where in the event of a national emergency, we can push things through quite quickly. It's a question of resources. So I don't think it's impossible, and I think it probably is a good idea to be able to do things on the time frame that we saw here.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your day job for a minute. You have discovered over 400 viruses.
Something like that.
Something. Do you get viruses in the mail? Do they mail you candidates?
Well, they actually do arrive by mail, actually by courier service. And what typically happens is that somewhere in the world, somebody will contact us about an outbreak or a single case of disease in a human or an animal, where there may be a collection of viruses that people simply want to know more about, and they will send those to us in dry ice, and we will use modern methods to sequence them and to characterize them, and we've got 65 people, very talented people, who do this work. I don't. I just, I sort of pontificate in the background and write screenplays. With Scott Z. Burns. But, you know, it's been an enormous amount of fun, particularly since I've been doing this kind of work since the early 1980s, when it was a much more tedious process. And the pace at which this information is accumulating is staggering. It's going up exponentially. So, you know, I can see that over the next few years, we're going to resolve not only all these sorts of, you know, outbreaks of acute disease, but also chronic diseases, the role of viruses and bacteria and things like diabetes and cancer and autism and what have you. So it's an enormous amount of fun and a great place to be. As I've told Stephen, I think he has the first, you know, I think I have a better job than he does. We disagree on that point.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR, talking with virologist Ian Lipkin. Have you seen any results from the publicity and people seeing the movie? Relating to viral research or the need for more money in research, anything like that?
Well, there are two things that we wanted to achieve, and I think I appreciate the question. One is that we do want to make sure that people realize that we need support in this area, and particularly in a time when funding is decreasing for science and it's in jeopardy. This, we hope, will lead people to realize that this is something we can need to support, because we're not like firemen and policemen that you see on the street rushing to an emergency of some sort. When public health people do their jobs well, you don't hear about us, right? We're successful. So we need to make people aware of what it is we do. The second thing, of course, is that we want to attract more people, some new blood into this field, because without that, we're not going to be able to progress. So increasingly, the work depends on mathematics and engineering. traditional public health people and people who grow viruses and bacteria. So I think it has made a difference, but we're only just getting started. Remember, it's only just beginning to be released in Europe, and we have a global view. So we're trying to attract as many people into the theater as we can so that they better understand what we do.
One of the most telling scenes in speaking about the economics of this is, was it the governor who comes in, was it Minnesota? And she says she's in this emergency health care facility they're trying to set up and say, who's going to pay for this?
That's exactly right. I mean, if we had an epidemic of this proportion, we would have a great deal of difficulty dealing with it. We don't have ways to isolate people. We don't have enough machines for artificial respiration. We don't have people who are sufficiently trained. So we're hoping to some extent that this is a wake-up call.
Mm-hmm. It's not like how are we going to get all these people in here and get them cured. It's how we're going to pay for this before anybody talks about it. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to a quick phone call before we have to go. Let's go to Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris.
Hey, thanks. I was a little dismayed. I just saw the film last night, dismayed to see my city decimated in the film. But I know Scott Burns is from Minnesota, so it was fun to see us up on the screen. But I wanted to ask if there was is it as bad as it was depicted in the movie, or could it be potentially much worse than what was depicted?
Well, I think what we depicted was pretty bad. The likelihood that we're going to have something like this happen in the near term is small. On the other hand, we can prepare for this. One of the things that we try to convey to people is one of the most effective methods we have to prevent spread is with social distancing. And this is not something that's very popular in the Western world, but the scene where Lawrence Fishburne says, "Do you know where this bit about shaking hands comes from?" Right, holding your hand out to show that you had no weapon, that you meant no harm. This was something that I encouraged Scott to put in there because I think that handshaking during months when we've got a lot of respiratory disease is probably not such a great idea, and coming to work when you're sick is probably not such a great idea. One of the misconceptions that you can draw from the trailer for the film, where it says, "Don't talk to anybody, don't touch anybody," and so forth, many people present that as though we're saying you should protect yourself by not touching anybody and so forth. But that particular scene is where Kate Winslet is telling someone who's on a bus, don't infect anybody else. So it really was a protect the herd, protect the community. And that's one of the messages that we're trying to get across in this film.
You think there's a sequel?
Not for me.
Too difficult? Too much time?
It was a lot of time. Yeah. It was an enormous amount of time. I spent 21 days on set, similar amount of time either training people or traveling on location or reading scripts. And, you know, my job is looking at real viruses. These guys can spread this gospel at this point better than I can.
And nothing spreads it like a film, does it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Good luck to you and good job on the film.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. W. Ian Lipkin was the senior technical advisor for the movie Contagion. He's also a professor of epidemiology and director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at the Mailman School of Public Health right here in New York at Columbia University. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Alessio Bayek. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.